Welcome to this Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amadei, host of World Poetry Open Mic and The Michael Amadei Show, publisher of World Poetry Magazine, musician, poet, and author of more books than I should mention. My collaborator and co-conspirator in this project is none other than Clifford Brooks. Cliff is the author of Athena Departs, and The Draw of Broken Eyes, and Whirling Metaphysics. He's the founder of the Southern Collective Experience and is the creative force behind the Blue Mountain Review. Our guest today is Vincent Zangaro. Vincent Zangaro is a musician and a full-time advocate for Alzheimer's and dementia patients and families. He's the founder of the Alzheimer's Music Fest and is the director of development and special events for the Dementia Spotlight Foundation. Vincent Zangaro's Alzheimer's journey began over a decade ago at the age of 29 after his father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at 68 years old, leaving him unable to care for himself due to rapidly declining health. Driven by the challenges he faced navigating his father's condition, a fire was lit in Zangaro to offer help to those living and affected by Alzheimer's and dementia-related illness. Drawing on his experience in the music industry, Zangaro founded the Alzheimer's Music Fest in 2013 to raise awareness and funds to help families care for loved ones. Zangaro also oversees the Atlanta and Tampa Alzheimer Music Fest. The Alzheimer's Music Fest has since become an annual rock and roll event, raising hundreds of thousands of dollars and helping hundreds of families care for loved ones. Without any further ado, here is our interview with Vincent Zangaro.
Today, on This Business of Music and Poetry, we welcome Vince Zangaro, Atlanta-based musician, founder of Alzheimer's Music Fest, and director of development for Dementia Spotlight Foundation. Vince, how are you, boss?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
It is an honor to have you here. Now, you hold a big place in the community of music and public health, and the fact that what you do with the Alzheimer's Music Fest and the Dementia Spotlight Foundation. And I want to get into all of that, but like Charles Dickens, I want to start at the beginning. So music, it's always been a huge part of your life. How early was it that it became your drive as a vocation?
I started my first band, Clifford, I think I was in fourth grade.
There you go.
I'm not kidding. Yeah, it's so funny. My parents bought me, I don't know if people, I'm 46, so this goes back a little bit, but bought me my first Willie Nelson guitar from Toys R Us.
That's awesome. I didn't know that was a thing, man. That's fantastic.
Willie Nelson had a picture on it and all that stuff, and it was so funny because it played like crap. It was Toys R Us. So what I did was, and I wasn't a Willie Nelson fan at that time, right. Which I am a huge Willie Nelson fan now, of course. But I went and did a cardboard cutout and put, our first band was called Heart Attack when I was a kid. And so we acted like rock stars before we knew we could actually play the instrument. That's where it started.
All right. When you got into your teen years, maybe even your early 20s, how did music evolve within you? How did it ground you or give you freedom or both?
It gave me both. You know, it was weird. I never really, you know, it wasn't that I was unpopular in school. I was actually pop, you know, I was friendly with everybody. I have a personality like that, but I wasn't really into sports. I did all that. Wasn't really my thing. My dad was a veteran. He also served in the reserves until the day he got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And so it gave me a place to outreach. I could always write. I wrote my first book, even like this really terrible book by the time I was like, I don't know, like 12. And I just started taking piano lessons and then just picked up the guitar and learned how to play it just from taking piano lessons. I was not a great piano player. So, and my keyboard or my piano teacher kept on saying, Vince, you do not want to learn other people's music. You keep coming back writing your own music. And so she was actually, her name is Peggy Still, who's very much still big in the music industry. Wow. And is actually one of the directors of the Grammy Board in Atlanta. And she's still good friends with me. And, you know, has done a lot of stuff with Stephen King, you know, placements, right, things like that. And was the first person that said, don't learn how to play other people's music, write your own.
Yeah.
She could actually see the talent back there. And that's where it kind of started. I'm like, I can actually just write my own and just kind of go with that. And I have not stopped. I still to this day do not play covers live.
And, you know, it's these, the strive towards originality that makes you stand out. And when I went to go listen to your music, and I made a Stevie Ray Vaughan correlation there, and I stand by it. I will not stand back. We'll talk about that later. Put a pin in that jab. But your music is extremely original. It's catchy and it's accessible. And people, I think jealous ones look down on those qualities, but it's deceptive in the fact that what you write, people want to listen to. You have albums out now, and you did early in your career. Tell us about the bands and the band that you were in the first time you had an album out.
Oh man, we were our first album. I think we were 14. I was the young one in the band, and I was supposed to just be the keyboard player. And we brought in two older guys that I'm still best friends with today that came in, and I got our singer quit, and I got pushed into the singer role in the writing role. And right. I know that's a common thing, but that's kind of what happened, because I was writing before that and I just got thrust into the thing. So by the time we were 14, we had our first album called Bug Out, and it was basically kind of like punk rock hits, but had a commercial quality to it.
Right.
And we were pretty decent as young kids. And all of a sudden we started playing these places like Rec Room and just getting these huge crowds, because all of us were from different high schools.
Right.
All throughout the thing. So next, you know, we play the Rec Room. There's over 300 people at our first gig, and it just keeps on going. And then it just went from there. And then we got management from New Santa Lana, which a lot of people might remember this band Stuck Mojo, and which turned into Fozzy. And then also Body and Soul, which turned into Seven Dust.
Yes.
And then
yes,
we were very young and on that same management. So the next thing you know, we're playing, you know, the Roxy and Masquerade in front of all these huge bands. And we're very young. They would even have to stink me in sometimes to get me into because I was underage.
Right.
And it just kind of evolved from there. And we did Bug Out, and then we did about 3-4 more albums from there. And I hate to say it, but what happened, to be honest with you, was the drummer slept with the guitar player's girlfriend, and that was the end of the band. Another
that cliche. Will do it, bro.
Another cliche.
It's a little harder. You can't really walk away from that one. You know, you can, but you have to keep walking.
Drummers have a reputation for a reason. My best friend's a drummer. That's right.
Michael Amadei chimes in. Oh, I know a little bit about this. Let me speak on these drummers now.
Those drummers, they are some
scandalous people. They will steal your women. Beware of a drummer.
No. So was that the band that you were playing with? That was that an evolution of Heart Attack, or was that a different project?
This is this and that. It was very much, you know, what's funny is they just bring me along for the ride, because I was not a great piano player. I was good enough to fake it, and I did everything by ear. I still can't, like, I can read music now pretty well, but like back in the day I did not know how to I was not good at everything happened in my ear. I just have a good ear to this day, which is almost annoying. But no, so this became with older guys came in, they wanted my drummer. He was a prodigy almost. Okay. And I was part of the deal. And then when I actually started writing all the songs, they couldn't get rid of me after that.
Like, oh man, he writes everything.
And so it evolved, but we did turn into be a pretty dang good band. You know, in high school, I listened to some of the stuff then. And I was like, man, you know, that back in the day, I went back and listened to a cassette tape, believe it or not, because I have a cassette tape in my car still.
Yeah.
Don't ask why, but I still have one.
Because it's awesome.
But it's not, you know, it sounds pretty good to this day. I was like, oh, that was pretty good for that time. You know,
man. No, see that is yeah. Think, you know, that's there's something about the projects you do when you're younger. You know, I started my first thing, I think, back, you know, like 8 years old, 9 years old, something like that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I still have old reel to reels, you know, that I recorded things on.
Right.
And, you know, and the thing is though, you can hear yourself finding your way, but I think it's kind of cool as a creative musician. I think there's a line to divide too, because a lot of people think, okay, well, someone who performs and someone who writes their own stuff, it's all the same thing. And it's really not. There is a difference between the performing side and the creating side. And some people,
I agree with you totally, very much so. And you know, just on that note, what I found is like, I'm always good. I'm good at improv. Always have been, never really took classes. I took classes later in life because I think that's a great thing to do, is be able to improv whatever you do in life. I think it's an important skill to be on your feet with anything, whether that's business, music, talking in public, talking like we're talking right now. Word. And so, but I did in my lyrics, I was like, man, I'm writing all these really good lyrics, but I didn't even know what they meant. Like I was, and then finally you see me as I get older and I go through some things in life that hit me. And, you know, unfortunately I went through some stuff earlier in life, had a great family life, but just some stuff that happened. And, you know, I'm pretty open about it. I got a song about it. I got molested as a kid by this terrible man that was friends with my father. And fortunately I was a lucky one where I saw it, got out of it, but you saw the songs growing in a different direction. I got way more deep and I started being able to bring all this improv into a structured, well-written format of a song to tell a story.
And see that I think that is a sign right there of someone who is a born creator, as we take these dark moments, these things that happen, and we're able to turn them and create something new. And we're able to take it in and create something that not only is a new piece of work, but is something that can connect with other people going through their own dark experiences. And then it actually turns it into a strength, you know?
Now I think music, and that's the one thing for me. And again, if you listen, like, you know, I try to balance some happy music because I do have a lot of melancholy, if you will, style things that I'm fans of.
Sure.
But, you know, I try to balance that out. But, and then it just continued because it also gives you no filter. Once you open up about certain things like that, you learn not to have a filter and just to kind of bare your soul through your music and not to be guarded at all. And as Cliff is getting to know me a little bit now, I really just don't have a filter. You know, I'm like, this is kind of who I
am. At all. At all. At all.
This is kind of who I am.
And no, and people think, dude, it's like literally, man, I'll say it. I tried to get through a show and not say this, but flattery is the only socially acceptable way to lie. And I don't do it. So I'm not saying, I mean, people say typically like no filter is a negative thing. You don't doubt where you stand with Vince. He just tells you, you know, and then people like, you know, that's brusque. Like, no. It's never mean. He's not cussed me once to my face anyway. You know, I mean,
well, I don't talk behind people's back. Either.
Exactly. How how is that level of honesty, your forthrightness, how has that helped you get ahead in business and life? Tell us about that.
Well, I think, you know, some people can take it, you know, as I've gotten more known through the peaks and the valleys of success in music.
Yeah.
And then even we'll talk about what it evolved to with Alzheimer's Music Fest later. But, you know, then my dad having Alzheimer's, he taught me even to be more like a lot of the stuff that we worry about, stigma, fashion, you know, whatever, that doesn't really matter. Just to find yourself and be yourself. I think that makes people at ease in most cases, but it can come off. I can come off sometimes, I know. It's not that I know everything. I do not think that. I do not think I have the right answer for everything, but I do. I am confident in who I am as a person now. And I think my father gave me and my mother gave me that very much. I'm confident where I stand. That's not an ego.
No.
I know what I think at. I know what I'm good at. I try to focus on the things I'm good at and try to better myself on the things I'm bad at. I mean, it's that simple. And I think if you tell people right up front who you are and everything, I think they're going to respect it or not like it. And if no offense, if you want to go live in the dream world where everybody's pretty and everything's perfect, well, go have fun with that. That's not the world I live in.
Sure.
I'm positive. I love it. But that's not the world I'm also real in. That's not the world I live in.
Yeah, man.
Well, I think there's something really kind of meaningful about that, because I've noticed that there's this interesting thing that happens with creative people where if you're not the self-destructing artist, that people get a little weirded out by it, right? And not that we're all perfect, like we all have our self-destructive stuff, whatever, but someone having confidence, if it is misconstrued as ego, it's usually by people who think that, you know, we all need to be insecure and, you know, faltering all of the time. I think that says more about them, right? I think when someone is not aware, you've been at it for a while, you know, I'm almost 41 years old, I've been doing this a long time too. I know what I'm good at. I know what I'm not good at. And I know how to communicate that. And I think that's the mark of a professional. That's a mark of somebody who's just done it for a long time. And that's important to be able to bring to the table.
But, you know, like I'm also, you know, with, you know, as this evolved, you know, I got a production deal. I was actually came after that band broke up. I went in and got really good at guitar, put way more than 10,000 hours in guitar. You know, they have that mark 10,000. You're good. And again, I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm the best guitar player, but I got a very unique style. And I don't know if that's because I was just really into South African music at one point, or even Dave Matthews. Like I'm a very rhythmic player. And I do all this crazy stuff that's probably not what you should be doing on guitar, but it works for me. And, you know, so it was one of those things that I got a production deal, you know, because I went and joined Hot Topic, became a regional staffing director, recruiter for them. So I got to travel, and I was still playing at that time. I was with Hot Topic for 10 years. Now Hot Topic became a mainstream company, but when I joined, it was about 20 stores. And so we grew this massive kind of head shop, if you will, into a mall that became popular. And it was still all about the music. I've always been, at that point, it really was still all about the music. And so when I came back about 5 years later to recording, I got my first production deal with Blue Blanket Studios, which is Jason Salzman, which Jason Salzman is very well known in the industry. He's a big wig over there at Universal Audio that does most of the huge studio equipment for all the big guys and producers out there. And he really, you know, I go back in there at like 34 years old, you know, really getting produced hardcore for the first time. And he, dude, I had homework every night. You know, it's not, you know, people have to understand that. It's not like you just go in with your music. When you give yourself over to a producer, which I extremely love, I love that. And someone that's actually good, it's going to beat you in the face. Like, you can do this better. You're not doing this good enough. You need to do that vocal track. Again, go home and practice your breath control. Go home and do this. What are you looking? And I had this stampede where I was like, I want to bring utility players in. I want to bring, you know, people that can play violin, banjo, and trumpet players, and saxophones. Like, it almost got too big because I had this production sale. And so I had actually time to find what I wanted to do without that younger band. And I thank Jason Salzman for that every day. And I'm going back in the studio with him soon to work on another project. And again, I don't want to be a rock star, you know. And that's the thing. It's like, back in the day, that's all I wanted to be, was a rock star. I want to be a rock star and get girls and, sorry, do drugs and, you know, those kind of things. And I got out of that pretty fast. And I stopped doing drugs when I was pretty young. And in my time, it was more hippie drugs. Yeah. You know, like, try, because in the 90s, we were trying to be hippies again.
Right.
You know, that was kind of the deal in the 90s. And so, just through that, I really found something. And through that, I found the players that I would be with for now to this day and for the next, probably the rest of my life, for the last, you know, 10 years or so. I pretty much had the same band.
That's great. That's great. And, and what you're talking about as far as the, what working with the real producer is, that is something that, it reminds me a lot of working with like a really good editor when you're writing something, right? So, but a producer is someone with the point of view who can really do something. There's a lot of people now with laptops calling themselves producers. It's not, I mean, and I'm not knocking them, but it's not the same thing as some of these people who've done, what, you know, 200 albums and know the gear like the back of their hand and know all of it, but also know the craft. And I applaud that. I think a lot more people need to kind of learn to give themselves over and work, collaborate with a producer on something. That's really a meaningful process, I find.
I do. And I think a lot of people need to get into it a little bit more, because I think we're losing, something's happening to music. And I'm not saying all around the board, because it's just a big, now it's just so much music's out there. I hardly can keep up with, because I know there's great talented people out there, but I hardly can keep up with it. So I kind of listen to my vinyls at home, you know, and all that stuff. I'm the big vinyl collector, and I always have been. So, you know, it's, but to go in there and really work with someone. And I switched one time and I went to Dan Dixon, which Dan Dixon's a really amazing producer. He's produced like the Biters and the Constellations, some of the most indie, big, you know, biggest indie bands. And he still does. He's going to be a great career. And then I worked with David Cobb back in the day. He played guitar for my band. David Cobb now, you know, just won 2 Grammys for Chris Stapleton. And, you know, all of these guys, and he found himself in Nashville, coming from LA to Nashville, and look at what he's done. I haven't talked to Dave for a long time, but, you know, the guys just totally became probably one of the notarized best producers out there. And so it's kind of interesting to see how it evolves and to see where you find that craft. And I think, you know, like I said, I haven't talked to Dave for a while, except for at the beginning when I started this, and because the guy got very busy. I think I think he just worked with the Bee Gees or something. I don't know. I look at his Facebook and I'm like, dang, dude. Don't want to bug you. I'm not going to ask you for autograph stuff for the music fest. You know? But it's pretty amazing to find yourself. And I think his concept was like, let's bring indie back to country. Let's bring that outlaw style back to country, because Dave was a rock guy, man, not a country guy. So it's pretty interesting just from afar to see what he's done. So I love seeing that with all different producers. And I got to tell you, producers, they go in there, they can play almost every instrument.
Mm-hmm.
They know every craft. And I respect that very much. I respect that as someone that does what I do now professionally in my career. I like to know how to do everything. I might not be good at everything, but enough to know what is the person I need to put in that position that can do it better.
Yeah, looking at a producer. Sorry to cut you off. Looking at producers as film directors, basically, film directors for music. You know, and I think what you're saying about the change happening in music too. I was just telling someone a few weeks ago. I went to this concert out at Red Rocks out here in Denver, hosted by John Waters, which cracked me up. I saw a guy named Charlie Crockett. He's a kind of a, almost like a Hank Williams, neo Hank Williams kind of sound now, old style country. And I saw 8,000 people, wildly diverse audience, just falling all over it and loved him so much. And of course that's the Orville Peck kind of, it's not quite country, but it's a country bit, you know, essentially, but it works. And it's really interesting seeing that transition.
And by the way, Red Rocks is one of my favorite venues, man.
Oh, yeah.
And I've gotten to see Dave Matthews Band there before. Oh, and I got to tell you, that was one of the best. Love Dave, hate him. I love him. I just find them freaking amazing.
Great musicians.
Just as songwriters, plus they get in this jam band, which I'm just getting the jam bands later in life, because I always kind of like the 3-4 minute song.
Yep.
The structure of that, I really always personally like that. Kind of what Clifford said earlier is like, my stuff is attainable because that's the way I write. Even though I like to be a little indie, I know where that chorus should be, that verse. It just comes to my head. I know what should maybe be catchy in my brain, and I hope that brings people into the meaning of my music and what I'm trying to say. But yeah, to see that. And then also, I've hiked it a couple of times, and I got to tell you, man, when you're not used to the altitude, you go out there.
I have a friend who runs up and down Red Rocks and then runs the trail and comes back wearing a 20-pound weight vest. And dude, and then she goes to a Krav Maga like 3-hour class. It's scary. I don't know. She's a scary person.
Well, I don't know if a lot of people know that haven't really spent time in Colorado, but people do that. Like, they literally go run. They go hike up and down and run those stands and those cement bleachers, if you want to call them that, like every day.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy. They're nuts, but it's a beautiful place. All right.
And so with all this passion, and knowing the roles and kind of the whole spectrum, the idea of it, you moved your toolbox, as it were, to create the Alzheimer's Music Fest and also be a part of the Dementia Spotlight Foundation. Tell us how you got into that and about the music festival in particular.
My dad was diagnosed at 62 with Alzheimer's. I was 29 years old, fairly young. His father had it. We didn't know the extent. Even though his father had it, we still were very ignorant about it.
Right.
Just like other people. And I think people take Alzheimer's dementia very wrong. Dementia, it's dementia. Alzheimer's is under that umbrella of Lewy bodies and vascular. And, okay. Just name it frontal lobe dementia. And then you have Alzheimer's. But Alzheimer's gets the most attention because it does hit more people. But, you know, so through the first 4 years, it got really hard. Dad started changing. It wasn't just memories. It was like he couldn't feed himself anymore. He couldn't go to the restroom. He was losing, and people don't realize that. Your brain starts to die. You can live well, but your brain starts to die. And with that becomes all these physical things. So when you look at someone that might be handicapped in a way and they're not able to walk in a wheelchair, you don't think Alzheimer's. Well, yeah, you should, because that's eventually going to probably happen.
Right.
And I started calling around to, like, I don't want to put people under the bus, but some of the larger Alzheimer's nonprofits, and they had no resources. I was just like, what do you guys do? And they're like, well, we're looking for a cure. And I'm like, that's great, but what, how about people living this? Because what you realize is insurance doesn't cover any of this. They still, in most cases, consider any form of dementia a mental disease, not a physical disease. So basically, even if you have good insurance, they're not going to help you cover home care. They're not going to help you get a wheelchair. It's getting better, but at the point with my dad, they would not do anything. And we were going broken. Dad needed 24-hour care. And so I started going back in the studio and creating an album called Pops. Uh-huh. And I named it after my dad. And most people would think it's Pops, like pop music. But that, right. Believe me, if you listen to the album, that's not it. And it was all the kind of issues I had with self-destruction, mm-hmm. which Michael brought up earlier, drinking, losing the house. Things just literally started going away, losing friends because they don't understand the disease. When I was so young, people didn't realize what was going on with me and my father. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, I started lying a lot to him, and I'm not a liar. But they didn't get it anymore. So I would like make up things like, oh, I got to do something else. But at the same time, here's my dad in the bathroom. And I love my dad. And I have great respect for him. And he's my hero. But I couldn't really tell him, well, my dad's rubbing feces all over the wall in the bathroom. And it's going to take me about 4 hours to clean this up and get him showered off and, you know, get home. And so I started doing these things because they couldn't take it at 30 or 31. They couldn't take mortality at that point. Which I still feel bad about to this day, but I just didn't know how to deal with it back then. But then I turned the loop on it and started blogging on Facebook and just got very honest about it,
right.
What we were all going through. And then we finally found a positive space. And in between that, I'm like, well, I know all these bands and these musicians, and let me try to do something that helps people now. And the one thing that my friend Gary and I at that point, which just recently passed, which was a true mentor to me, because I wouldn't work with some of the bigger nonprofits. I worked with the small ones that I knew the money was going straight to the community at that point. And we started doing free home care, which in our language is respite care, to give caregivers and to give that loved one a break. And then it just slowly evolved where it started. We did three the first year, dude. I about died trying to do three. And I was caring for my dad.
Yeah.
So I was doing everything from home, caring for my dad full time. And we did three. We did two in Atlanta, or two in, one in Marietta, one in, two in Marietta, and then we did one in Athens, Georgia in 1 year.
Oh.
And all these musicians started coming out. You know, I knew a lot of them, but like, you know, 5-8, that's pretty well known in Georgia.
Uh-huh.
And all these people just started coming out in the Law Band back in the day. And then it just started growing from there. And then 10 years later, it was slow. And it was not easy. It was not easy. I did not know. I knew shows, I was around music, but I did not know how to do a festival. So I made so many mistakes at the beginning. I booked 24 bands in 10 hours, the first fest. It was ridiculous.
Right.
You know, and it just started evolving from there. And I said, okay, let's slow down and let's do this right. Let's find the way we can do it right. And then slowly more artists got more attracted to it. But it was not overnight. And most things I know are never overnight.
No. No, no.
Well, the best things aren't. Yeah.
No, exactly. Sure. Exactly.
Yeah. And then how to mention Spotlight Foundation about, you know, five years going into that fest, how that came up was they were doing their first event at Buckhead Theater. It was their first big event. They just founded Dementia Spotlight Foundation. I did not know Whitney. She's like my sister now. One of my best friends. She's definitely my sister in our mission. They asked me to come play the event because I was getting a lot of press for being, I hate to say it, but the Alzheimer's singer-songwriter guy, and getting a lot of press from my dad, and I have all the tattoos and piercings and the crazy hair, and I look pretty young comparatively, and also people were interested because men aren't, you know, it's getting better now, but men aren't normally the primary caregivers in a situation, so they also wanted to look at that, and I played the show at Buckhead Theater, and I met Whitney. And she was just founding this stuff. And we just, our father started, to be honest with you, declining at the same time.
Right.
And we just bonded through late night calls and what we wanted to do as missions. And we've been together ever since. And then she lost her dad about 7 months before my father. And I held my dad's hand right in my living room. We were at home hospice and playing beautiful music in the back room. And you guys met Chappie Bird earlier.
Right.
My cockatiel and Chappie was by his side the whole time. And I was with him for 18 days until he took his last breath. And then after that, let's just say if I didn't have a fire up my butt, man, to do something about dementia before that, I basically took all my grief and I had Whitney now. And became part of Dementia Spotlight Foundation. First, it was really just Whitney and I and a few other people and, you know, in the background, but really Whitney and I out in the field. And I just went, I didn't know how else to do because I was a caregiver for 14 years. And something about caregivers is you have work ethic. You don't have time. You don't get breaks. You don't get vacations. You do not get any of this. All you know is how to work and move forward and to try to make every situation the best possible and any kind of outcome. And I just didn't stop, man. Basically, that helped me in my grief of my father. I just kept going and going and going. We grew pretty fast from that point.
Right.
I just didn't know what else to do.
And it's with that same verve and drive, compassion, the focus that you have, that you continue to apply it to today. And what I mean by that is there's been, because of COVID, the upsurge, we've needed to move back your Alzheimer's Fest to next year.
Yeah.
Tell us about what we can look forward to. We know we don't have a date, but just tell us about some of the folks that are involved in that.
Yeah, it's really cool. It really does stick. We have to postpone, but I think that was the right thing for us. Absolutely. In Atlanta, the Delta variant's very high. I'm vaccinated. I try not to push that, but I'm vaccinated.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm seeing breakthrough infections a little bit, where most of these people that are vaccinated, they're getting through it just fine, of course.
Right.
They're like, oh, it's like a small cold.
Right, you know? Right.
But I can't.
But things as they are. Yeah, dude, I get it.
Yeah, I can't sit there and justify doing an Alzheimer's Music Fest. And then there's a lot of restrictions. I won't get into that. With the restrictions, it almost logistically just becomes impossible to do what I feel we need to do at this point.
Yeah.
So it will be sometime, you know, in the next 6 months. And we're talking about dates right now. We should have that shortly. But yeah, then just slowly, you know, one of the first bands that came on board, because they're an Atlanta band, and I've gotten to know them through the years, is Driving and Crying.
Mm-hmm.
Which a lot of people might not know, and if they're not in the southern region, mm-hmm. but they're like a crown jewel in Georgia.
Yeah,
they still sell their songs. I mean, Going Straight to Hell, I guess it was what Darius.
I was just about to sing that song. I was just about to sing.
Yeah, man. And they're truly nice guys, and I've got to know Kevin through the years, Kevin Kenny, and mm-hmm. they're truly nice guys. He's touched, and so they were one of the first really big national bands that we had to put on this thing. And then they did Tampa for us, because we now do a fest in Tampa, because we brought on our amazing education director, Gary Joseph LeBlanc, that trains first responders and does all of our education, free education events for people on dementia. Mm-hmm. So we started doing it in Tampa also.
Cool.
And then we brought Reverend Horton Heat on the next year, which I was like,
So
I just started to know bands and management. And once you start kind of knocking down those doors, at first they won't talk to you. You know, you can't just call these people up. You got to, people know that you can't really just call these people up. You really kind of have to start being in their circle, and that they got to earn trust in you.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, I'm sitting there, I talked to Arrested Development, their management, 3 years. I know the guitar player very well, JJ Boogie. And I was like, man, I really want to get you guys on this thing. I want to have diversity in the fest.
Yeah.
I don't want to just be rock bands. I want to bring hip hop in here.
Right.
I want to bring all that in here. And so then Arrested Development came, and then Cracker came, because Felina worked at the Tabernacle, which is David Lowry's wife. And she's a huge promoter in Athens and deals with 40 Watt. His, dad passed away at Lewy Body's dementia. And so now we have Arrested Development, Cracker, and Driving Crying. To me, it's a dream show.
It is.
And then many amazing local bands that I'm good friends with, like Guru Fish and POS, and Ralph Roddenberry and Donna Hopkins. I can go over. These are people that are staple in Georgia. So basically, it's like just this huge Georgia fun feel where, these three major acts are huge, you know, I mean, Arrested Development's won Grammys and stuff, you know, yeah. And Cracker was on the top 10 for year, or that first 2 years all over the place. Right. But the one thing you would learn about music with these guys is they're hardworking, man. This isn't the rock star life. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what people put in their brain of being a rock star, but that's not what this is. They come with a trailer, dude. They come, you know, they all have different things they're doing. They still tour throughout the year, but this is hard. You know, they're not millionaires. They're not what people think.
Well, they're working.
Hardworking musicians. They're hardworking musicians. And I really started to learn that, you know, this rock star dream I had built up in my head as a young thing just does not really exist unless you're that pop singer /, you know, maybe even Foo Fighters. I love the Foo Fighters, but the Foo Fighters deserve that and they earned it and they got there. But it's most of the bands in this, 95% of the bands and musicians that are in this, they're doing this. This is their life. And if they can survive off of it and make a decent living, then they're happy doing what they're doing. And it's hard work. Hard work.
I think it's easy to think of musicians as, you know, they all have to be incredibly wealthy and whatever, because they're up on stage in front of hopefully, you know, decent sized crowds. I've started to see musicians, especially through, you know, my own work and chefs is very similar, right? Like a chef can be successful, but they're still in the kitchen working. They're still bringing it. They still have a team. The team has to execute perfectly. They have to make something happen and it's work. And they dedicate their lives to it, you know?
It is. I mean, if you were to Google me, like I had this incident a while back where my dog got in a fight in the dog park. Anyway, I know it's weird, but yeah, this pit bull came up on him and my dog's park hit and whipped it and took the pit bull down. And everybody was all right, but they got in a dog fight. But these people started Googling me. And I was like, well, if you Google me, dude, I look like I'm something way beyond than what I'm at. And I didn't do that on purpose. It's just because if you get press and you're in the social eye in any kind of way, it makes it look a lot bigger than you are. And I'm sitting here where, you know, I'm still living because we really believe in giving that money to the families. And I do make a moderate salary now, but it took me 8 years to make a salary at doing what I did, enough to survive to do this full time. And then I do a lot of side things too, with music and placements and name it, booking even. I mean, I have the best thing I can tell musicians. If you love it, it really takes a rare quality to have that sort of passion. And if you love it, learn 10 different things in it. You know, that's the best thing. I don't want to discourage people from wanting to be a rock star because those things still happen. You know, I think the Avett Brothers did it beautifully, you know, the way the Avett Brothers are doing things now. They kind of did it on their own terms, but they did it all themselves. I watched that documentary and just went back and watched the Driving Crying documentary and see how hard this is. Just don't look at those few rock bands that had this great success. Really go look at the heart of this and learn different trades in it. It'll make you happier. Because now I go play music for fun. And I will never lose music or money for music anymore. And to me, that's being successful. Me just not losing money.
Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us. And we want to say thank you to Vincent Zangaro for a great conversation. You can find Vincent at alzheimersmusicfest.org. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or at southerncollectiveexperience.com. You can find myself at michaelamade.com, worldpoetrymagazine.com, and worldpoetryopenmic.com. Until next time, remember to be yourself. The world needs your authenticity. Do the hard work and conquer your obstacles creatively. Remember to follow your heart. For it's easy to lose your head in this business of music and poetry.